picture of her.
Not that. Thank you and good evening. Pastor, it's such an honor to be here. I wasn't expecting that. Usually, you know how these introductions go. Somebody reads what you've given it. And I've heard it so many times that I get tired of hearing it. So I tell people less is more. Don't read a whole lot. But I'm thankful for the warm reception you've given me. I'm here in part because my dear friend from high school asked me to be here. Raymond Thomas and I went to high school together a few years ago. And I may wear out my welcome by saying this, and I won't be invited back. No, I'm not going to tell the stories that are out of school, so to speak. But even when he was in high school, we used to have a nickname. We called Raymond Minister Raymond Thomas. That's another story. But he and Dolores are my dear friends. But also, this invitation was one that I just didn't want to say no to. And so I'm honored to be here. But I want to be candid with you. I don't know how well this is going to work out. I had a brief exchange with Pastor, and he told me, he made clear to me that the expectations are not too high. That is to say, I'm not a preacher. I know that. You know, as I said, I'm like Popeye. Those of you who remember Popeye, I am what I am. And I'm a civil rights lawyer. Now that doesn't mean that I am out of my element in church or in a place where we come to worship God. Lord knows if I'm out of my element there, I'm in trouble. But I also am conscious of my, I'll say my shortcomings, and one of my favorite hymns is one that you may know. And the words, in part, say, "Prone to wander, Lord, I feel it. Prone to leave the God I love. Here's my heart, Lord, take and seal it. Seal it for thy courts above." You know that hymn, don't you? And so that part that talks about prone to wander, Lord, I feel it. Prone to leave the God I love. But then the other part, "Here's my heart, Lord, take and seal it. Seal it for thy courts above." And so, I love that hymn. I want to do one other thing before I begin to talk about the work that I've done, though. And I want to read one of my favorite passages from the Bible. I am sometimes, we have to be New Testament people, but I'm also partially an Old Testament guy. Proverbs 31, you know it in part because of the good wife. And I heard, I think, a woman say, "All right." But I may be in trouble with you because that's not the passage that I'm going to read. The words of King Lemuel, the prophecy his mother taught him. "What, my son, and what the son of my bowels? Give not thy strength unto women, nor thy ways unto that which destroyeth kings. It is not for kings, O Lemuel. It is not for kings to drink wine, nor for princes strong drink, lest they drink and forget the law and pervert the judgment of any of the afflicted. Give strong drink unto him that is ready to perish, and wine unto those that be of heavy heart. Let them drink and forget their poverty and remember their misery no more. Open thy mouth for the dumb in the cause of all such as are appointed to destruction. Open thy mouth, judge righteously, and plead the cause of the poor and the needy. Now, my favorite interpretation, the last few words are, open thy mouth for the speechless in the cause of those who are appointed to die. Open thy mouth for the needy and plead the cause of the poor and the needy. Open thy mouth for the speechless. So, I'm a civil rights lawyer, as you've heard now several times. I got there because I grew up during a time, the 1960s, in which there was this great movement that fundamentally worked a change in this country. I remember as a boy, when I was living with my grandmother in Harlem before we moved to the Bronx, I remember something that for years I thought was a dream. At least I had this vision in my head. I was on the east end of 125th Street. Now I know I'm in Chicago. But any of you who know 125th Street in New York, you know that it is the main artery in Harlem, 125th Street. The Apollo is on 125th Street. I'm not going to talk about how Harlem is changing now. We could have that discussion. But my Harlem, 125th Street. And in my vision, I don't know where it came from. I thought it was a dream. On the east end of 125th Street, near the entrance ramp to the Triborough Bridge, you know what I'm talking about, Raymond. There were people lying in the street, and they had newspapers on top of them, and trucks and cars and buses were pulled up right next to them, and they were blocking those trucks and cars and buses, and the drivers were mad because they couldn't go over the bridge. All the traffic was stalled. I don't know where it came from. Years later, when I was in college, I was doing some research on a thesis on civil rights, and I came across on microfiche a story about a demonstration in Harlem in the late 1950s. I was probably 5 years old or so, in about 59. And folks laid out in the street to block traffic. They were demonstrating against the refusal of store merchants to hire African Americans on 125th Street. And apparently, with my grandmother, I must have witnessed that. Kind of made sense, but the only thing I got wrong was that the newspapers weren't on top of them, they were underneath them to keep them from getting their clothes soiled. The 60s was a time of great change. The civil rights movement was the context for my youth. And so, fast forward, and I won't go into all the details about this, but you know, Raymond and I are cut from the same cloth in many ways. Grew up in public housing projects, went to Catholic school, which I always say now was my salvation and my damnation. It's my salvation because we got a good education. My damnation because once those nuns got in my head, I never got them out. And we went to the same high school, and it was a predominantly white high school, academically a very good high school, but we had a very active black student organization. I won't tell you about all of that, but we share that. It was a great story, and we ended up in a group for black male high school students that made all the difference in my life. If it were not for that group and that organization, I wouldn't be who and what I am now. Irish American, Roman Catholic priest. Now, I came a point where I no longer squared my life with Catholicism, but eventually I came back to God and the church, prone to wander, Lord, I feel it. Prone to leave the God I love, but I came back. But early on, I did figure out that I wanted to do something meaningful in my life. And I wanted to be part of this long struggle that I learned about in my youth for civil and human rights for African Americans. My goal, even when I was in high school, was to become a civil rights lawyer. And I admired Thurgood Marshall. Thurgood Marshall was the first head of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. We all knew him in that role, as well as being the first African-American justice on the Supreme Court. I had the great honor in my last iteration at the Legal Defense Fund. I worked there for about 26 years. But the last job I did there was to be the director counsel. Now, I'm going to be candid with you. It wasn't my favorite job there. When you have to raise money and deal with board members and all of that, but it was a great honor. I was the fifth director counsel of the Legal Defense Fund, but it's the years that I spent there in other roles that I treasure more than anything else. I did work on school desegregation cases all around the South, Alabama and Louisiana and Georgia and states that I spent a good deal of time on or in. I also worked at the Legal Defense Fund on a capital punishment case. This defendant was in the state prison in Louisiana at Angola. Perhaps you've heard of it. Angola is an old plantation. It is one of the most infamous prisons in the United States. And that's saying something. You know, Parchment in Mississippi, Angola in Louisiana. And without telling you all the details of why this man was on death row, he obviously had taken a life. I can tell you that when I got his case, he had an execution date that was 2 weeks away. His lawyer had not filed the notice of appeal. I called him and said, you know, there's no notice of appeal. Can I at least get the record? And the lawyer said, there's a flood in Louisiana, and my basement is flooded. I'm busy trying to deal with that, and there's not much you can do anyway. You know, he's going to be executed. And I said, well, if you're not going to do anything about this, will you let me get the record? Long story short, went down to Louisiana, procured the record, began to work on a stay, went to the state courts, knew we weren't going to get it there, went to the Supreme, the U.S. District Court, knew we weren't going to get it there, went through all the way from the to the appellate court, the federal appellate court, and then to the U.S. Supreme Court, and we got a stay at the last moment. And then I, along with another lawyer in Louisiana, we worked on his case. Now, the issues were not issues of innocence. I can't tell you that this man didn't do it, but his trial was polluted with racial discrimination. The jury that was selected, no black people, every black person struck from the jury. The defense counsel didn't put on anything in mitigation of the death penalty. When you found out about his life, he was, as a child, abandoned by his father. He went to juvenile detention facilities early on. He lived with his grandfather. When his grandfather was around, he'd come home, pass some woman's house, see his grandfather's car, and get home, and his grandmother would say, "Was granddaddy's car out there in that driveway?" And he'd say, "No," and she'd beat him for lying. And if he said yes, his grandfather would come home and beat him. So a lot of abuse. He started acting out, stealing cars. He ended up, I'll give you the short version of the story, ended up in an adult jail and was raped as a juvenile. He was on his way to a bad, dark place. Now, let me be clear. I don't think that this was a question of excuses. You know, nobody who takes the life of an individual the way he did, it was a routine gas station robbery. He robbed and shot a truck driver. There's no justifying that. There's no excuse for it. But there are reasons why people are the way they are. I have a dear friend, Brian Stevenson, who does a lot of death penalty work. And Brian has said many times that we're all more than the worst thing that we've done in life. Think about our own lives. You know, there's something that we do that we're not proud of. I mean, most of us haven't killed somebody, thank God. But we're better than the worst thing we've done. So anyway, I worked on that case and eventually was able to get his death penalty vacated and then plead him out to life without parole, which was just fine because, frankly, he needed more time out. I remember one conversation, I probably shouldn't share this with him, in which he told me that when he got out someday, he'd come and visit me and my wife. And I thought to myself, well, thank you for that thought, but no thanks. In any event, capital punishment, death penalty work, very unpopular. Had an opportunity to do that kind of work, but I worked on all kinds of cases. I happened to notice before I left my office today in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, a plaque that I have that I value. And it was from a small community in Indio, California, a black and brown community where the city in Indio near Palm Springs was trying to take the homes of this small community of color. Black man moved there in the 1920s from Oklahoma and couldn't buy land in Palm Springs, so he bought outside of Palm Springs. And the city of Indio grew up around him. In the meantime, he subdivided his land and sold plots to other African Americans and Latinos and eventually Vietnamese. And that became this community. Eventually, a mall was built next to it, and then the mall wasn't doing so well, and the city decided it wasn't doing so well because of these brown and black folks who were there. So they were going to take their land. They didn't have plans to compensate them adequately. They were going to use eminent domain. And we represented the folks in that community. We ended up getting new houses built for the homeowners, and we got good relocation for those who had to leave, but most of the folks were able to stay. That was, for me, not one of the biggest cases I ever did in terms of the notoriety, but it's something that I felt a lot of gratification about. It was making a difference in people's lives. I worked on cases involving voting rights. You know, the right to vote is the crown jewel of civil rights legislation. The right to vote is something that our people fought and died for. It is sacrosanct to me. When I hear people say that they don't vote because it doesn't make a difference, because they're all corrupt, or they think that they're all as bad as the next person, it's not a choice between the perfect and the imperfect. It's a choice between the imperfect and the really imperfect. But whatever your politics are, your responsibility as a citizen, in my view, is to vote. I worked with a family of one of the martyrs of the civil rights movement down in Hattiesburg, Mississippi, Vernon Damer. Lost his life when his home was firebombed because he was advocating for the right to vote. So in 1966, his home was firebombed by the KKK, and the house burned to the ground. Pastor, because I know of your service to this country and in our military, in the Air Force, he had four sons. Among his children were four sons, each one of them in a different service. And I remember seeing the photograph of those four sons who were called home from all around the world when their father died. And they were standing around the perimeter of this, what had been the house. It was still, you know, embers burning, smoldering. All of them in uniform, you know, Air Force, Army, okay, Marines, you know, the Navy, all four of them, serving their country, called home because their father was killed because he was advocating for the right to vote. You think about the power of that photograph. I looked at it and I cried. On Vernon Damer's gravestone are these words: if you don't vote, you don't count. I think about Vernon Damer when people say they just aren't going to bother voting. I can tell you, for African Americans, registering to vote is connected with jury services. But all of our citizens, they're connected. And a lot of people try to duck jury service. You know, I mean, I suspect there might even be a few people in this room that have tried to duck jury service. But if you think that there's a criminal justice system that is unfair, I think maybe you have an obligation to serve on juries. It's part of citizenship. I've worked on employment discrimination cases. I've worked on cases involving access to higher education. Time doesn't permit me to talk about those cases. The Michigan cases, some of you may know about, went to the Supreme Court back in 2003. I was deeply involved in those cases. In fact, I'm going to throw modesty to the wind. This is immodest, but it's true. I taught at Michigan Law School for a few years. And when I got there, I found out that Michigan was doing something in admissions that I thought was problematic because it wasn't compliant with the only governing case on this issue, the Bakke case from 1978. And I went to the then dean, and we argued round and round about it. I told him that we had to change the practices at the law school in admissions to make the law school as litigation proof as we could. We had to do what the Supreme Court had said. We weren't doing that. He was smart, thoughtful. He got it eventually and appointed a committee. I served on that committee. that committee redid the emissions program, but if it were not for that process, there wouldn't have been a program to uphold in the Michigan cases when they went to the Supreme Court. We're talking about access to higher education for black and brown people in institutions that have had excluded them. So it's been an honor to do those kinds of cases. I could go on and talk about the cases that I was blessed to work on, the people I was blessed to represent. But let me just shift, knowing that, as I said, I don't want to wear out my welcome, and tell you about some of the issues that we're working on now. I moved to North Carolina a couple of years ago from New York. I was teaching at Columbia Law School after I left the Legal Defense Fund. And I moved to North Carolina because one of my colleagues from the Legal Defense Fund was Jack Boger, who had become the dean of UNC Law School. But also, in North Carolina, there was a man you may have never heard about. And I ask you to write his name down and Google him. I'm going to tell you a little bit about him anyway. His name was Julius L. Chambers. You know, Southerner. He had a Southern name, Julius LaVon Chambers. Julius grew up in a small town in North Carolina in the 50s. And his father owned a repair shop, trucks, cars. Somebody brought a car in, a truck in, rather. His father did the work, and the man refused to pay. And Julius watched as his father was helpless, had no power to do anything about it. Lawyers in town, only three of them, they wouldn't take the case. And so he never got paid. It was humiliating. And Julius decided at that moment that he was going to become a lawyer. Fast forward, he eventually goes to what's now North Carolina Central, which is one of the historically black universities, as you know. He graduates summa cum laude. That's saying something. You know the old joke, right? You know, some of us get to graduate, thank you, Lordy. But he graduated summa cum laude. And then he went on to earn a master's in history from the University of Michigan. By that time, it was the end of it's about 60. He comes back to North Carolina and he enrolls in UNC Law School, one of the first black students. And he graduates from UNC Law School in 1962, which in and of itself would place him in history. But not only did he graduate from UNC Law School in 62, but he graduated number one in his class. Julius died a few years ago when a few of us were going down, driving out to his funeral. We remarked that, first of all, I never heard Julius say he graduated number one in his class. And we said, if he graduated number one in his class at UNC Law School in 1962, it couldn't have been close. You get what I mean? You know, they would have taken it. But not only was he number one in his class, but he was also the editor-in-chief of the Law Review. Prestigious position. You know, I think he was the first black, I know he was the first black editor-in-chief of a Law Review at a predominantly white law school. And yet he couldn't get a job at a law firm. He couldn't even get an interview when he graduated. Eventually, he went up to New York and he met with Thurgood Marshall. Thurgood Marshall brought him into the Legal Defense Fund in a program he created for interns. Had two interns. The first two were Julius, and the other one is someone whom you should know of. Marion Wright, now Marion Wright Edelman, head of the Children's Defense Fund. Julius goes back to North Carolina after a couple of years in New York, opens up the first racially integrated law firm in the South. And he starts filing case after case employment discrimination, school desegregation, voting rights cases. He's dealing with criminal justice issues, on and on. His house firebombed, his home firebombed, his car firebombed, his father's house firebombed. Julius just kept on going. He was very low-key. If you met him, you'd be thrown off. You wouldn't know you were in the presence of brilliance because very low-key, he was one of the great mumblers in life. And most of the time, hands in his pockets, jingling paper clips or, you know, change or whatever. But meanwhile, brilliant tactician, brilliant lawyer. Eventually, he becomes the third head of the Legal Defense Fund. Then he comes back and becomes Chancellor of North Carolina Central. But the last thing he did in life was create this Center for Civil Rights at UNC Law School. That's Julius Chambers. And we lost him a couple of years ago, but we should know who these people are. You know, we should keep them alive with us. So Julius was trying to get me to come down to UNC. Jack Boger was trying to get me to come down to UNC. And so one day, my wife and I, we were on the deacon board. We were sitting in church, and there was some drama going on. And she turned to me, and she said, you know, maybe we ought to. And so next thing you know, we're down at UNC. There's a lot going on in North Carolina right now. North Carolina had rolled back voting rights, had rolled back protections that had been enacted when the legislature was a different legislature that required the court system to look at disparate impacts of the criminal justice system. Rolled back same-day voting registration, required voter ID. Some of you probably sit here and say, I don't quite get the big deal of voter ID. You know, I mean, we all have IDs. We have driver's licenses, passports, right? What's the big deal, right? We ought to, because, you know, the legislatures that pass these laws say that they're trying to get at voter fraud. So we don't get it sometimes. You know, I explain it this way. You remember Katrina? You remember we watched the television reports, 24-hour news cycle, as people were lining up and their cars were on the bridges and the roads and the highways, the city was evacuating, it looked like everybody was leaving, right? And then we found out that everybody wasn't leaving. Tens of thousands of poor black people and brown people who were left behind because they didn't have the means to get out. Same thing with right to vote. Everybody doesn't have an ID. Everybody doesn't have a driver's license. Everybody doesn't have a passport. My grandmother, my maternal grandmother, who was a domestic worker, I remember she was struggling a good chunk of her life to find her birth certificate, and she was never able to get it. Born and lived in the United States all her life, stepped out of the United States for about an hour or two when I had the bad judgment to take her to Tijuana when I was living in California. Otherwise, she's an American all her life. Never was able to find it. In-person voter fraud is so rare that it's virtually non-existent. It is a solution that's looking for a problem. And so it's been imposed because people are trying to fence some folks out of the political processes to keep them from voting. Okay? And so, you know, in North Carolina, when they imposed that law, they knew what they were doing. Go and find me in-person voter fraud. Now, I get myself in trouble, and you all will never invite me back because, you know, I would acknowledge that I've heard stories about dead people voting in elections in Chicago and all of that. But in-person voter fraud is virtually non-existent. So, North Carolina, people ask me, why are you moving down there? And my answer was, you know, some people run from fires, some people run to them. And it is ground zero in civil rights right now. And so running the Center for Civil Rights and holding an endowed chair in Julius Chambers' name, it's a great honor for me. It's the place to be right now for me. Pastor, I know my time is basically up, but I want to shift, if I may, just to one more thing. As time has passed, you know, I've really only touched in a very cursory way on a few things that I've done in civil rights work. But as time has passed, I think about my frustrations with our laws, the way our Constitution has been interpreted. I'm not going to go and tell you all of the frustrations and explain what they are. If I had endless time, I'd do it. But I'm coming to another stage in my life when I'm beginning to realize that it's important to talk about some things that are not constrained by law. You know, law is important. I'll continue to do this work. But it is insufficient by itself. And in some ways, it is in conflict with the notion of a just society as our laws stand. Martin Luther King used to talk about the beloved community. And to talk about the beloved community, given the shortcomings of the way our Supreme Court has interpreted the law, is oxymoronic in some ways. And so I thought about this, and I thought about the need to talk beyond law and to ask what those principles are. And in many ways, what we have to talk about is that beloved community. We have to talk about values. I'm not trying to say that other faiths don't share these values, but for those of us who are Christian, we have to talk about those Christian values. You know, what Christ taught, and it's why I'm comfortable being a Christian. What Christ taught was do unto others as you'd have done unto you. Christ consorted with the least of those in his time. Prostitutes, right? Tax collectors. People who were reviled and disrespected. I'm conscious of the message that he left to us. I think about the issues that our country is struggling with now with respect to race. I think about Charleston and that massacre there with that sick young man. I think about the Black Lives Matter movement. I'm glad to see those young folks standing up. And there are so many people who are criticizing them. They're too this, they're too that. They are opposed to law enforcement. Look, I respect law enforcement. I respect them when they do their jobs and find a way to do those jobs without violating the rights of people of color or anybody. Those two things are not inconsistent. So I think about those issues. I think about how we talk about race generally. You know, we're supposed to be in a colorblind society, some people tell us. We're not. You all know that. Just look at the news. Think about the terminology that we use. We talk about blacks and whites. So the descriptive becomes the nominative, as if it's the most important thing about someone. How can you say that and do that at the same time claim that we're colorblind? You know, clearly we're not. I think about, and I'm aware of this fact, I think about standing here before you, and I'm a light-skinned, freckle-faced African-American. I say to my wife, I joke with her, and she says, you shouldn't make that joke. But I say, I'm a mutt of a man. I'm just joking, though. But here's what I really mean. Do you remember in 2008, during the same cycle in which President Obama was elected, there was a gentleman, and I use the term loosely, in Missouri. He was running for the Senate from the House. His name was Aiken. Do you remember him, anybody? Anybody? Hands up if you do. He made a statement. Nobody, maybe one person here. He made a statement that caught a lot of attention. The statement was about legitimate rape. Does that refresh anybody's memory? His theory was that if women were raped, there was something, a biological defense that came into play, and it blocked pregnancy. He really said that. And so he was criticized. I'm not making this stuff up if you didn't hear about it. He was criticized by women and others, any thoughtful people. But here's what I thought about. There are millions of African Americans in this country whose very countenances on a daily basis put the lie to what he said. Do you follow me? I've done a lot of genealogical work. I'm still doing it. I can't find any white folks in my lineage. Maybe somebody's there. But I haven't found anybody post-slavery. Think about what that means. And that's true for most of us. Okay? So why am I talking about all this? I'm talking about the way that race and our history still comes down through the ages to define who and what we are today in significant ways. In 3 years, 2019, we will commemorate the 400th anniversary of the arrival of Africans involuntarily at Jamestown. I'm thinking about that a lot and planning something. But 3 years, if you stay with me for a minute on this, for 350 of those years, if we use Brown versus Board of Education as a cutoff point, black folks were subordinated by law in either slavery or Jim Crow segregation. I know we try to antique slavery. It ended in 1863 with the Emancipation Proclamation, or 1865 with the 13th Amendment. But it's a continuum. There's no cutoff. It's a continuum. There was another 100 years of slavery-like condition under Jim Crow segregation. And so if you go to Brown versus Board of Education, it actually ends up being 335 years, pardon me, of what is now 397 years. That's 8 out of 10 days of the presence of Africans in what's now the United States. But you can't stop in 1954. You got to at least go forward to about 1970, because it took the Civil Rights Act of 1964 before discrimination in employment was illegal, before discrimination in federally funded programs was illegal, before discrimination in public accommodations was illegal. It took the 1965 Voting Rights Act to finally give meaning to the 15th Amendment, protect the right to vote. It took until 1967 for the Supreme Court to strike down bans on interracial marriage. It took until 1968 for housing discrimination to be illegal. 350 out of 397 years as we are here today. 350 out of 300. So that's more than 8 out of 10 days of the presence of African Americans in what became the United States. Why am I dwelling on this? Because I'm obsessed with it? With race? No. That's not why. Because it's our history. It's the truth. That's why I'm obsessed with it. And when we disconnect that history from present day inequality, say there's, you know, they have no connection anymore, that's why we get the policies and the discourse in law and a social discourse, political discourse, that is distorted and illegitimate, in my view. So as we come up on this 350th anniversary, I think it's important to have some more of this discourse and to talk about who and what we are as a nation. All of us, not just black folks and brown folks, all of us, because this is the American story. This has been central to the United States. Slavery was the issue over which the founding fathers, as they're called, almost faltered. The country was almost stillborn over that issue. We had a civil war about that issue. You get the point. You know, it is one of the most important and profoundly vexing issues in our country. And it's still work to done. It's still unfinished business. The church has been central to that struggle. The civil rights movement of the 50s and 60s grew out of the black church. Not only the black church, but surely the black church. There are people I know who say that black folks shouldn't be following Christianity because it didn't serve us well. It was a religion of the slave master. You know, there were Christians who were un-Christian. But Christ's message is one that reverberates with African Americans, for all of us. So I see that connection, and it's important to make that connection, to celebrate it and talk about it. Finally, and I do mean finally, there are a lot of people who are cynical these days, dispirited about the politics of the country, about the politics of race. You know, a lot of people who are dispirited. I deeply believe in hope. Not the kind of schmarmy hope that is naive. We don't see or understand or recognize the reasons why people might be or may be cynical. There are all kinds of reasons for people to be cynical. I understand it. I can understand why people want to despair. But I believe in a different kind of hope. I believe in the kind of hope that is about a choice. Hope is a choice. You make a decision that you are going to live your life guided by faith and hope, and work to change the things that we don't like in the world around us. That's a different kind of hope. What's the alternative? The alternative is unpalatable, right? Am I right about that? So I believe in that. I believe in struggle. And so I close with a Swahili proverb that I love. I started with proverbs from the Old Testament, and I close with a short Swahili proverb. It says that life has meaning only in the struggle. Victory and defeat are in the hands of the gods. So let us celebrate the struggle. Thank you.